Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, a podcast from The Independent. I'm Ben Kelly, and each episode we'll be speaking to our correspondents and other experts to better understand what is happening around us in the worlds of politics, culture, sport, and more. Now this week we're discussing quite a remarkable scientific breakthrough, the possibility of life on Venus. Researchers have spotted phosphine, a rare and toxic gas, in the atmosphere of our neighbouring planet, suggesting that it may be home to alien life. This story has been our most read on The Independent this week, and here to discuss it is our tech editor and science reporter, Andrew Griffin. Andrew, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Andrew, we often cover these amazing space discoveries, which you do so well. And sometimes, you know, it's about something that's been found from the past, or it's just a sort of a sliver of something's existence. I'm not for once sort of suggesting that you overblow these things, but this one really is quite big, isn't it?
It is, if it's true. I mean, you know, there's that famous Carl Sagan quote that says, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And I think, you know, even though scientists are, I wouldn't want to put a percentage on it, but fairly sure that there's no other explanation for what's going on here. Obviously, they want to be more than fairly sure, absolutely certain, I suppose, before you start going on about aliens. So with that disclaimer out the way, if it does turn out that there is life in our solar system, not just in our solar system, but actually right next door on the planet, just kind of one planet along, that will obviously be, you know, a discovery on the scale of, you know, the unimaginable, really, to think the kind of profound change that difference would make to the way we think about basically everything. So yeah, that's why everyone was just so excited this week, because it is, you know, a discovery that would change history in so many ways. And one of the scientists that was working on actually mentioned, you know, 2020 has been so traumatic and terrible in so many ways, but it may be possible that in 100 years or however long, it's actually the first detection of the possibility of life that maybe 2020 will be remembered for. So that would be exciting. It takes something big to fix 2020, but this could be it.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it as positive news, I suppose. I hadn't really thought of it like that. We read about this gas, this phosphine. So what have they actually found? How can you describe that to us?
So it's almost equivalent to sniffing it, was the word that I used when we were speaking about it when it came out. You can pick up a kind of what they call a spectral signature, which basically means that you can see in a vaguely metaphorical way the chemical makeup of a planet. You can do that from really far away, because what you're actually looking for is the way that light interacts with those chemicals, and that allows you to then infer what's happening on that planet. So we can do this outside of our solar system even, which is pretty amazing. So that's what they picked up, the kind of unique signature of this gas, phosphine.
And sort of, excuse my ignorance, but how do scientists go about gaining this? I mean, you know, how close do we have to get? How can you extract something like that from another planet, from another atmosphere?
So it's a ground-based telescope. Obviously, we often hear about discoveries like this being made by either space telescopes or probes that have visited those worlds, and clearly those can be incredibly useful, and hopefully off the back of this we might send one to Venus. But we can actually as I mentioned, learn an awful lot about other planets, even planets an awful long way away, just by actually looking at them. We've got this telescope going into space, the James Webb Space Telescope. Hopefully at some point soon, it keeps getting delayed. But that's very good at this work, which, as mentioned, is basically looking for the kind of signatures of light. You know, if you were to think of it in the most basic way, it's like the haze that comes off the atmosphere. And as you look at that haze, this is very much simplifying it, but you can see the kinds of wavelengths that get of light that get to us tell you what's happening on that planet. Does that make sense? It's obviously much more complicated than this, so complicated that I certainly couldn't do this and couldn't explain it at the most complex level. But basically, you're picking up a signature of what's going on that planet by looking at the kind of light that you're getting from it.
Yeah, I do understand. You've reduced it quite well, I think, for even the novice among us. And is that something that we are doing to many planets? Are we looking at many different planets for these kinds of detection, or is it only the ones that are closest? Or because we often hear about Mars, don't we, but Venus not so much.
Yeah, Venus is a bit of a surprise. And actually, one of the really nice things about this study was the beginnings of it. They weren't looking at Venus for life, that's for sure. They weren't actually even looking at Venus necessarily to learn anything about Venus. It was a kind of calibration effort just to see. And indeed, they picked up phosphine. They were looking for phosphine because they believed there was going to be none there. So it was a way of kind of setting a benchmark for when you look at a planet, what's the kind of possible things you might see. There's not going to be phosphine. Let's try and see it effectively, given we know it's not going to be there. So as part of this test, they turned this telescope towards Venus, looked at it, and were shocked to find phosphine. Now, the exciting thing is that over the last few years, and especially last year, there's been all this research that suggested that phosphine could only come on rocky planets like Venus from life. So as soon as they spotted that, this began this whole fairly Hollywood process of linking up all these various scientists who, you know, getting the ones who'd done the first observations in contact with the people who'd done this work on phosphine and what it might mean. And that's when they realized they'd got something really exciting going on here. And especially because, as you say, Venus famously described as literally being like hell because it's so hot that it would melt lead. It's incredibly acidic. It's not a very nice place to live, and therefore, you know, it wasn't one of the places that people were getting especially excited about. Those are, as you say, Mars. There are some moons, Europa and Enceladus, further out into the solar system that might have water and therefore might be quite exciting for life. But Venus is really, it's kind of a surprise entry into the life stakes, and it's now gone all the way up to the top, the most likely, or at least most kind of concretely informed possibility really now.
So let's take this to the most basic question that's sort of lingering on everyone's minds when they saw this and shared this across social media this week. Does this mean there are aliens on Venus?
The big question. I mean, to go back to what we were speaking about at the beginning, really, there is, as far as scientists know, no other explanation. So they tried ruling out, you know, all the other possibilities. One of the researchers is describing this kind of mission through the scientific literature to check if there's any other possible process that could form phosphine. So they were checking, you know, could lightning strikes make this gas appear? Could it come up through volcanoes? Could there be some kind of process that they'd not thought about? And all of that work came to the conclusion, no, there's nothing else we know on a planet like this that could be making that happen. Now, scientists being kind of, you know, characteristically cautious, wouldn't say that means it's aliens, because there's always the possibility, you know, Venus is still reasonably unknown. There might be some other process going on. There's very little chance that the phosphine detection is a mistake, so that's definitely happening. But you know, they always want to leave the possibility that it's not. Now, accepting all of that, and that's kind of, you know, there are really no more cautious people in the world than scientists. So they'll tell you about that first bit an awful lot, and then they'll say at the end, but really, there's no other explanation, which is the kind of key bit, you know. We can equivocate and prevaricate all we want, but it does appear that the most likely explanation is there's something living on there and sending out this phosphine that we've spotted, yeah.
And so you describe Venus as being like hell, and it doesn't sound like somewhere you'd want to live. So what on earth kind of thing would manage to survive in that environment? I know we're speaking completely hypothetical, but are we talking about some sort of plant life, or some sort of, what kind of things could possibly survive in such a habitat, do you think?
Yeah, so it's probably not a kind of plant life. It's probably, and it's certainly not, you know, your kind of alien with a big round grey head.
That's my whole idea gone now.
Yeah, no, it is a shame. Well, one of the, you know, that's the kind of strange thing about this alien detection. Obviously, you say aliens, and there's this picture of maybe we'll be saved by some people in UFOs and incredible spacesuits. But no, it's almost certainly a single-celled kind of something like a bacteria that we have here on Earth. Bacteria is a fairly kind of earthy idea, so it's probably something very different to bacteria, but that's sort of the way of thinking about it. It's something very simple, single-celled. It's going to have very interesting things going on, that's for sure, because you know, up in the, even in the clouds, which is where it's thought to be living, the clouds above the surface of Venus, it's still incredibly acidic. It's like 85%, I think, sulfuric acid. So clearly there's going to have to be something about their biology that makes them able to live somewhere like that. We do have things on Earth that are able to live in very acidic conditions, nothing like that, nothing quite as acidic as on Venus. But so there's going to be interesting biology going on there, that's for sure. And that's one of the reasons scientists want to go and see what they might look like. But no, we're not going to be having conversations with them, or even really, are we even going to be able to see them in anything other than a microscope?
And so what's going to happen now? Is there going to be a push towards maybe directing more resources towards Venus, or putting more funding into it? And indeed, what bodies are going to do this? What countries are going to be interested? Is this a NASA thing, or, you know, is it even worth pursuing further?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they can carry on doing ground-based telescope work, which is, you know, complicated and expensive, because there's only a limited number of these ground-based telescopes, and a limited amount of time that you can use on them. So that will be able to tell us more. But the, you know, the real hope and dream of the researchers who discovered this, and of, I mean, basically anyone who's excited about these aliens, is that we do actually go there, and that clearly is even more expensive, even more complicated. There are plans for missions to Venus. A number of space agencies have them. This is obviously going to increase the excitement, I think, about getting those done. The dream, you know, among any space agency is obviously to find alien life. And there's, I think, arguably a new space race happening now. You have China, you have the UAE, you have all sorts of other countries that want to show off their kind of space abilities. So no doubt there's going to be a bit of a rush to get there. So it remains to be seen. It may be NASA, it may be someone else entirely. But the dream is that you send a spacecraft to the planet and you either do some work there, or the kind of really fantastic dream is to go there, pick something up and bring it back down here.
Yeah, and the, you know, we talk about this in terms of the novelty of it, don't we? You know, are there people out there? Is there life out there? And indeed, maybe there are things we could learn from looking at it. But are there things that, you know, if we were to find life or bacteria or things like that on some of these planets, what use would they have to us as humans on Earth? And is that something that we're considering when we're going out there and looking?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a kind of high-minded idea that we should explore these things just for their own sake. But I think one thing is we don't know what use they're going to have until we actually see them. The big question that, you know, astrobiologists would like to answer is, what are the processes that are happening to effectively power this life? You know, are they using DNA and RNA like life on Earth does, or are they using entirely different systems to to keep themselves alive and propagate more of whatever they are. Now, the answer to that, whichever way it goes, is fascinating, because if it's the same as Earth, that probably suggests that we both have a common kind of ancestor, and that there was one beginning of life that has spread across the solar system. If the answer is the opposite and it turns out they're doing something entirely differently, that would suggest that life has formed twice effectively. And both of those tell us something really important about, you know, where human life came from. And, you know, it's very easy to imagine, although impossible to really pin down, the kinds of things that answering that question would give us in terms of understanding, you know, both the history of human life and also the ways that we might be able to change, affect, really have humanity continues to live and all those sorts of things.
It's fascinating. And as you say, it's a sort of welcome respite from the rest of the news cycle. And actually, you know, you're not content with just having the most read story on The Independent this week, with life on Venus, but you've had a bit of a shot chaser situation, because you also had a big story about the new solar cycle, which NASA announced. Tell us what that means.
One thing is it's slightly less positive news. It's slightly more 2020 in as far as the, you know, so the sun goes around on these 11 year cycles of activity, during which activity and weather kind of goes up on a slope and then comes back down again. The beginning of a cycle effectively means we've reached the low point and we're going back into a busy period that we'll get to in probably kind of 2024, 2025. Solar activity is fairly mysterious, actually, despite how important the sun is to us. We don't know as much as you might think about how it actually works and what it actually does. But it's also very significant. So it can change. It can have important effects on astronauts who are out in space, who aren't protected by the Earth from solar weather. It can also have really important effects on things like radio transmissions. And in really extreme cases, that can have knock-on effects on all sorts of technology and things. Now, the one that we're heading back into is probably going to be fairly kind of chill. The last solar cycle was also fairly chill. It looks like the sun is in a fairly mellow mood at the moment. So there's no great danger of things falling apart, at least in this respect, anytime soon. But it's, you know, if nothing else, it's a opportunity to think about how we might need to protect ourselves against solar weather and all the kind of attendant dangers that come with it.
I see. Well, Andrew, we're gonna have to keep an eye on Venus, I think. But for now, that's all we've got time for. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you're a new listener to Behind the Headlines, then please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever else you listen. And if there are stories you'd like to hear discussed on the show, maybe you want more tech, science, then please let us know. You can email behindtheheadlines@independent.co.uk. You can also support the show and all the original journalism at The Independent by signing up as a supporter. Details of that are in the description of this podcast. I'm Ben Kelly. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.